The border between our very Egypt and the territories that the Hyksos hordes had overrun was never clearly demarcated. The fighting seemed to fluctuate on a daily basis as attack followed counterattack, and the fortunes of war ebbed and flowed across the land. We had left from Thebes on the fifth day of the month of Paini. At that time, Lord Kratas had driven the Hyksos invaders back 20 leagues north of the town of Sheikh Abada. However, we were now well into the month of Epiphi, so much could have changed in our absence, but we still had the element of surprise on our side. Neither the Hyksos frontline troops nor our own men fighting under Lord Kratas would be expecting the miraculous appearance of a fleet of Minoan warships in our Nile, over 400 leagues from the shores of the Middle Sea. There were no ships on the southern stretches of the Nile, either Hyksos or Egyptian, that could oppose our triremes. We had just proven that we were unstoppable. Of course, the Hyksos might fly pigeons to try and warm their troops, who stood between us and Egypt. But pigeons are free spirits and fly only to where they were hatched, and not to any other destination that their handlers might prefer. We did not anchor at nightfall. Because we were now in familiar waters, and we knew every bend and sandbar, every channel and every obstacle in this section of the river. 6 days and nights after we left Memphis, a few hours before midnight, just as the moon in its first quarter was rising, we passed through the encamped armies. The watchfires of the opposing legions were spread out for several leagues along both banks of the Nile. There was merely a narrow strip of darkness between them, which demarcated no man's land. Our own ships showed no lights except a tiny shaded lamp on the stern, so we could keep contact with each other in the darkness. These dim lights were not visible from the river banks. I did not wish to be recognized by either army, so we kept to the middle of the river. We sailed through unchallenged, until at last we were back in our very Egypt. In the dawn, we ran into a small flotilla of 8 river galleys coming towards us from the direction of Thebes. Even at a distance, I could see that they were laden with Egyptian troops, and they were flying the blue colours of Pharaoh Thammuz. I knew that these must be Egyptian supply vessels bringing up reinforcements for Lord Kratas' army. As soon as they saw our strange squadron bearing down on them, every one of them put over the helm and tried to fly from us in panic. During the previous few days, I had ordered my men to stitch together crude but effective blue pennants in preparation for just such an encounter. Each of our triremes hoisted one of these at the masthead, and the galleys pulled into the bank and let us pass. The crews stared after us in astonishment as we sailed on towards Thebes, with only a passing salutation. I am certain none of them had ever seen ships like our triremes. This was a meeting that I would have avoided if it were at all possible. It was far better that the fate of the treasure triremes remain forever a mystery to the supreme Minos in Crete. He must never doubt that the Hyksos were the false allies that robbed him of his hoard of silver bullion. To achieve this, I had to ensure that our captured prizes, colossal and conspicuous as they might be, disappeared without trace. This was a task that might have daunted a lesser man, but I had already devised the solution. In the time before our people were driven from their homeland by the Hyksos, before the Exodus, our ruler had been Pharaoh Mamos. At that time, I, Taita, was the slave of Lord Intef, who was the nomarch of Karnak and grand vizier of all the 22 nomes of Upper Egypt. However, among his numerous other titles and honorifics, my master was also the lord of the necropolis and the keeper of the royal tombs. He was responsible for the upkeep of the tombs of all the pharaohs past and present, living and dead. But much more importantly, he was also the official architect of the tomb of Pharaoh Mamos. My lord Intef had never been gifted with any creative skills. His talents were vested more in havoc and destruction. I doubt that he could have designed a cattle pen, or even a pigeon coop, let alone an elaborate royal tomb fit for a pharaoh. While retaining for himself the royal gratitude and favours that went with the title, he left the arduous work, that which was not to his liking, or which was beyond his limited abilities and skills, for me to attend to. My memories of Lord Intef are not happy ones. It was he who commanded one of his minions to take the gelding knife to me. He was a cruel man and utterly ruthless. But in the end, I had decisively settled the score between us. Long before that happy day, it was I who designed every chamber and tunnel and funerary hall of Pharaoh Mamose's magnificent tomb. Then I supervised and directed the builders, the masons, the artists, and all the artisans that were called upon to labour in this enterprise. Pharaoh Mamose's outer sarcophagus was carved from a gigantic single block of granite. It was sufficiently commodious to encompass a nest of 7 silver coffins, which fitted neatly one within the other. The innermost of these was intended to contain Pharaoh's embalmed corpse. All this added up to a burden of massive bulk and weight. This had to be transported in great reverence 2,000 yards from the funerary temple on the banks of the Nile River to the tomb in the foothills of the Valley of the Kings. To accomplish this transit, I surveyed and built a canal that ran as straight as any arrow from the bank of the Nile across the riparian plain of black soil to the entrance of the royal tomb. This canal was wide enough and deep enough to accept Pharaoh's funeral barge. Pharaoh Mamose had been overtaken by destiny and had never lain a single day in his tomb before the Hyksos drove us out of our land. When we embarked on the long exodus, we were commanded by his wife, Queen Lostris, to carry his embalmed body with us. Many years later, Queen Lostris ordered me to design and build another tomb in the savage Nubian wilderness thousands of leagues further south. This was where Mamose now lay. The original tomb in the Valley of the Kings had stood empty all these years. More importantly for my plans, the canal that I had built from the funerary temple on the bank of the Nile to the royal tomb was still in an excellent state of repair. I knew this because only a short while previously I had ridden along the bank with my 2 little princesses to show them their father's empty tomb. I must admit that neither of them showed much interest in this lesson in the history of their own family. Even after all these years, I was able to recall the precise dimensions of Mamose's funeral barge. My memory is infallible. I never forget a fact, a figure, or a face. Now I measured the overall dimensions of our requisitioned Minoan treasure triremes. Then I ordered Zaras to anchor briefly in calm water, while I swam down to the trireme's keel and measured the amount of water she drew with her full cargo of bullion in the hold. These measurements varied somewhat from ship to ship. I returned to the surface, well pleased with the results of my investigations. Now I was able to compare the dimensions of Pharaoh Mamose's funeral barge with those of the captured triremes. The funerary canal would accommodate the transit of the largest of my triremes with 10 cubits to spare on each side of the hull, and with clearance of 15 cubits of water under the keel. What was even more encouraging was that all those years ago I had lined the canal with granite blocks, and I had designed a system of locks and shadoofs to keep it always filled with Nile water. It has been my experience that if you defer to the gods with the full reverence and respect that they deserve and expect, they are often inclined to return the compliment. Although they can be capricious, this time they had remembered me. I planned the last leg of our journey to arrive at the entrance to the funerary canal shortly after the setting of the sun. In darkness, we tied up at the stone jetty below Pharaoh Mamose's funerary temple. Of course, Mamose is now a god, and has his own temple overlooking the Nile. It is but a short walk from the jetty on which Zaras and I landed. It is not a very imposing temple. I must accept the personal responsibility for that. When we returned to Thebes after the Exodus, and we defeated the Hyksos at the Battle of Thebes, my mistress, Queen Lostris, was determined to dedicate a temple to her husband, the long-dead pharaoh. She wanted to honour him, and at the same time render up thanks for our safe return from the wilderness. Of course, she summoned me to build the temple. When I saw the extent and sumptuousness of the edifice she had in mind, I was shocked and alarmed. It would have overshadowed and outshone the great palace of the pharaohs, which would face it from the opposite bank of the river. Pharaoh Mamos had almost reduced this very Egypt to penury with the erection of his two tombs, the one here at the entrance to the Valley of the Kings, and the other even more complex and expensive tomb in Nubia. Now my mistress, whom I adored and worshipped, planned to bring the nation low yet again with the erection of another astonishing building in his memory. Fortunately, I have considerable sway over her only son, the present Pharaoh Tammuz, who is a sensible lad. To a much lesser extent, I learned from long and bitter experience how to control the wilder excesses of my queen. The dimensions of the temple to Mamos that we eventually settled upon were half the size of the tax collector's building in Thebes, and I even managed to do away with the marble floors. An establishment of this size no longer required the services of as many priests as my queen had in mind. I whittled away at her resolve until finally she threw up her hands in resignation and agreed to my counter-proposal of 4 priests, as opposed to her original estimate of 400. Now, when Zaris and I made our way up from the river to the rear entrance of the temple and walked into the nave without announcing our arrival, we discovered the 4 religious gentlemen rather more than moderately inebriated on cheap palm wine. They were in the company of 2 young ladies who, for some arcane and obscure reason, were without clothing. They were engrossed in a prayer ritual with 2 of the priests of Mamos, which seemed to consist of rolling around on the floor of baked mud bricks, clinging together and uttering cries of wild abandon. The 2 unoccupied priests stood over them, clapping their hands and exhorting the worshippers to a more strenuous display of religious devotion. It was some little time before any of them became aware of our presence. At that point, the ladies hurriedly retrieved their apparel and disappeared through the secret door behind the statue of the god Mamos. We did not see them again, nor were they mentioned in our subsequent conversation with the priests. The priests of Mamos are well disposed towards me. Since the death of Queen Lostris, I have made myself responsible for the payment of their monthly stipends. The 4 of them knelt in front of me, genuflecting vigorously and in the name of the god calling down blessings on my head. As they knelt at my feet, I produced the hawk seal of Pharaoh from under my cloak. They were struck dumb with awe. The high priest crawled to my feet and tried to kiss them. He smelled overpoweringly of sweat, cheap wine, and cheaper femininity. I stepped back, and Zaras dissuaded him from further demonstrations of piety with the flat of his sword across his bare buttocks. Then I addressed the 4 of them briefly but firmly, warning them strictly that the presence of 3 large warships moored at the wharf outside their front door must never be mentioned or admitted to anybody but Pharaoh Tammuz in person. In addition, armed guards would be placed over their temple and the empty tomb at the far end of the canal both day and night. Only those men under the command of Captain Zaras were in future allowed to enter the sacred precincts. These same guards would ensure that the 4 priests themselves would remain strictly incarcerated within these precincts. Finally, I commanded the high priest to hand over to me the large bunch of keys to the tomb and all the other monuments under his charge. We left them still protesting their duty and devotion to me and Pharaoh, and their strict obedience to my orders. Zaras and I returned to our ships. The fall in the ground from the entrance to the Valley of the Kings to the dock on the river was less than 20 cubits, but it required 4 separate locks to lift each of our triremes that height before we could bring them to the tomb. We rowed the first ship into the lock below the temple and then closed the gates on it. The water level in the lock was 5 cubits lower than that in the canal. I demonstrated to my 3 captains how to open the ground paddles. Water from the upper canal then drained down into the lock and slowly lifted the enormous ship up to the same level as the upper canal. Once the gates were closed behind her, 50 men on the tow lines were standing ready to drag the great trireme down the canal to the next lock, while behind her the process was being repeated to raise the second trireme. None of my men had ever seen anything to match this, which was not surprising, because I had invented the system myself. There was not another like it in all the world. They were elated and excited by what they perceived to be witchcraft. But there was usually hard work involved in my kind of magic. Fortunately, I had over 200 men to apply to this labour. These included the slaves that had been chained below by the Minoans. They were now freed men, but they were obliged to work for their freedom. The water that was drained from the higher canal to lift the boat had to be replaced. I achieved this by pumping up fresh water from the river by means of a battery of shadoofs. These were counterweighted bucket chains, each served by 2 men. It was an involved and laborious business that had to be repeated 4 times with each trireme. Before each boat was lifted through the first lock, the sails and masts were lowered flat on the upper deck. Then the hull was covered by woven reed mats until it resembled a shapeless mound of trash. When the citizens of Thebes awoke the following morning and looked across the river, they would see nothing untoward on the far bank. The 3 great triremes had disappeared as though they had never existed. It was almost sunrise the next day before we had towed the ships across the plain and moored them at the entrance to Mahmoud's tomb. The men were exhausted, so I ordered Zaras to issue them with extra rations of dried fish, beer and bread, and let them rest through the hot hours of the day. I walked back along the towpath of the canal to the temple. The priests seemed to have recovered from the strenuous rituals, devotions and prayers of the previous evening. They rowed me across the river in the temple skiff. I was on my way to report on the success of our expedition to Pharaoh. This was a pleasant duty, to which I was looking forward immensely. My devotion to Pharaoh is exceeded only by that I had for his mother, Queen Lostris. Of course, it is futile to compare superlatives, so I deliberately do not mention my royal princesses in this equation. Let it suffice to say that my devotion to the royal family extends to all its members. My tame priests landed me on the steps below the bazaars of the waterfront of the city, which were already thronged despite the early hour. I set off through the narrow streets towards the palace gates. Under my battered helmet and filthy face mask, nobody recognized me, although a gang of small ragamuffins danced around me, calling me vile names and throwing stones at me. I caught one of their missiles in mid-air and returned it with considerably more force than I received it. The urchin, who was clearly leader of the gang, screamed with pain and clutched at the wound in his scalp, which was fountaining copiously, and he led his followers in the flight for safety. When I reached the palace gates, I removed my disguise, and the captain of the household guards recognized me at once. He saluted me respectfully. "I must see Pharaoh," I told him. "Send a messenger to tell him I am waiting on his pleasure." "I offer my apologies, Lord Taita." I did not correct him. I was becoming accustomed to my new title. "Pharaoh is not in Thebes. We do not expect his imminent return." I nodded. This came as a disappointment, but as no real surprise to me. Pharaoh spends the greater part of his time and energy in prosecuting the interminable campaign against the Hyksos in the north. "Then take me to the Chamberlain, Lord Aton." When I reached his private rooms, Aton rushed to embrace me at the door. "What tidings, old friend?" he demanded. "How went our venture?" Grave tidings indeed. I assumed a gloomy expression. The treasury of the Supreme Minos in his fort at Tamiat has been plundered, and King Beon has been murdered. He held me at arm's length and stared into my face. You jest with me, good Taita, he accused me. All honest men must weep to hear it told. Who would commit such heinous crimes? Alas, both committed by the same hand, Aton. One that you might recognize, mayhap. And I held up my right hand before his face. He stared at it with cleverly feigned mystification. To have survived so long in the role of royal chamberlain, one had to be a gifted thespian. Then he shook his head and began to chuckle, softly at first, but the volume of his mirth built up swiftly until he was snorting and hooting with glee. He staggered around the room, bumping into the furniture and laughing. His belly and every other part of him were shaking with laughter. Then, abruptly, he stopped laughing and fled to the adjoining closet. There was a moment of silence, but before I could follow him, there came a sound like the flooding of the Nile through the cataracts. It went on for some considerable time before Aton returned to where I waited. Now his expression was once more serious as he adjusted his robes. You are fortunate, my dear friend, that I reached the pot in time, or you might have been drowned like King Beon. How do you know Beon was drowned? I have ears and eyes other than those you see in my face. If you know so much, then tell me about the treasure of the Minos. I have heard nothing of that, he shook his head ruefully. Is there aught you might have learned about it? Only that you were wrong. In what way was I wrong? You told me that the treasure might amount to 100 lakhs, did you not? He nodded, and I went on. You sadly miscalculated. Can you prove it to me? He demanded. I can do better than that, Aton. I can let you weigh it, I assured him. However, I must get a message to Pharaoh before we leave the palace. Aton pointed to his writing case, which lay open in a corner of the room. Write your message, and Pharaoh will have it in his hand before nightfall, he assured me. My message was short and cryptic. Please be patient with me, I begged Aton, as I handed it to him. But I have not bathed or worn fresh apparel for almost 2 moons. I must visit my own quarters here in the palace before I return with you to the tomb of Mamos. I did not think it worth mentioning that neither had I seen my 2 little princesses since my return. As soon as I reached my quarters, I sent one of my slaves to the quarters of the royal women to convey a message to their highnesses. The 2 of them arrived with the force and fury of the Khamsin wind out of the desert, just as I was stepping into my hot tub. They are the only ones in all the world that I allow to see me unclad, except for my slaves. However, my slaves are all eunuchs, as am I, so they are of no account. Now Tehuti and Beketha perched on the marble surround of my tub and pestered me with questions. They took no notice of my nudity. Once, many years ago, Beketha had spoken for both of them on the subject. You are just like me and Tehuti. All 3 of us look so much neater, without all those dangly things hanging in front of us. Now she paddled both her neat little feet in my tub and complained. It's been so boring since you went away. Whatever were you doing that took you so long? You must swear that next time you will take us with you. I poured a pitcher of hot water over my head to avoid taking the oath she had set for me. Did you bring us a present, Taita? Or did you forget? Tehuti took over the interrogation. As the elder sister, she had a firmer grasp on the intrinsic value of things. Of course I brought you both something. How could I ever forget you 2 little pests? I replied, and they clapped their hands with delight. Show us! Beketha chirruped. Oh, yes, darling Taita, Tehuti agreed. Please show us. We do so love you. Then fetch me my pouch. I pointed to where it lay on my couch in the adjoining room, and as always Beketha was first to reach it. She came dancing back to me, brandishing the leather pouch. Then she flopped down onto the marble slabs with her legs crossed under her and the pouch on her lap. "Open it," I told her. With my princesses firmly in mind, I had selected 2 pieces of jewellery from the loot we collected from the Minoan officers whom we captured at Tamiat. "Is there something in there, wrapped in red cloth?" I asked. And Becatha squealed with excitement. "Yes, my best and most lovely Taita. Is it mine? Is the red one mine?"
"Of course it is."
Her hands were shaking with excitement as she unwrapped the small parcel. As she held up the golden necklace, her eyes filled with tears of delight.
"It is the most beautiful thing I have ever seen," she whispered.
Suspended from the chain were 2 golden figures. Although they were tiny, they were complete in every exquisite detail. The largest was an image of a charging bull. Its head was lowered, ready to butt, with its viciously curved horns. Its eyes were tiny green stones that glittered angrily. Its humped shoulders epitomized brute strength and fury. It was attacking the other figure, the slender form of a beautiful girl. She seemed to dance just beyond the reach of those deadly horns. There was a garland of flowers around her head, and the nipples of her breasts were a red rubies. Her head was thrown back as she laughed at the raging bull.
"She is so quick that the bull will never catch her."
Becatha bounced the necklace between her hands to make the figures dance.
"You are quite right, Becatha. She is the charm against danger. While you wear it, danger can never catch you. The bull dancer will keep you safe from all harm."
I took the necklace from her hands and fastened the clasp behind her neck. She looked down at it and shook her shoulders to make the figurine dance against the lustrous skin of her boyish chest. She was lovely when she laughed. Tahuti had waited quietly for me to give her my attention, and I felt a little guilty as I turned to her. I don't like to show favourites.
"Your present is in the blue cloth, Your Royal Highness."
She unwrapped it carefully and gasped as the ring sparkled.
"I've never seen anything shine so bright," Tahuti cried.
"Place it on your middle finger," I told her.
"It's too big, it just slides around."
"That's because it's a very special stone. You must never show it to a man, except..."
"Except what?"
"Except if you want him to fall in love with you. Otherwise, you must keep it concealed in the palm of your hand. Remember that the magic will only work once, so be very careful to whom you show the ring."
She wrapped her fingers tightly around it. "I don't want any man to fall in love with me," she replied firmly.
"Why not, my sweetling?"
"Because if they do, then they try to put a baby inside you. When the baby is in, it does not want to come out again. I have heard the women in the harem scream, and I don't want that."
"One day you may change your mind," I smiled. "But the stone has other qualities that make it special."
"Tell us, why is it so special, Taita?"
Becatha was not deterred by her sister's silly scruples.
"One reason is because it is the hardest thing in the entire world. Nothing can cut it, and nothing can scratch it, not even the sharpest bronze dagger. That's why they call it diamond, the hard one. Water cannot wet it, but it sticks to the skin of the woman who owns it, like magic."
"I don't believe you, Taita."
Tahuti looked dubious.
"It's another of your made-up stories."
"You just wait and see if what I tell you is true. But remember," I wagged my finger at her sternly, "don't ever show it to a man unless you love him very much, and you want him to love you forever."
I will never know why I told her that, except that the girls love my stories, and I never like to disappoint them. I stood up from the tub and called for Rusty, my head slave, to bring a towel to dry me.
"You're going away again, Taita?"
Tahuti accused me. She had a grown woman's instincts. "You come back for just an hour, and then you're gone again. Perhaps this time it will be forever." She was close to tears.
No, no. I dropped the towel and embraced her.
That is not true. I am only going as far as your father's empty tomb on the east bank.
If you're telling the truth, then let us come with you, Becatha suggested.
Oh, yes, please, let us come with you, dear Taita, Tahuti insisted.
I paused to consider the suggestion, and I found that it appealed to me, as much as it seemed to do to my girls. There is just one problem with that idea. I feigned reluctance. What we are going to do is a big secret, and you will have to swear not to tell anyone else about what you see and what we do there.
A secret? Becatha cried, and her eyes sparkled at the thought. I swear, Taita, I swear by all the gods, I shall never say a word to another living soul.
The three treasure ships were still moored alongside the wharf at the entrance to Pharaoh Mamosa's tomb when the princesses, Aton, and I arrived there. Zaras and his men had worked well in my absence. Following my instructions, they had rigged screens of reed matting around the tomb precincts to prevent us from being overlooked from the surrounding hills. I was determined to work all night to get the triremes offloaded. However, Hyksos spies might creep in closer under cover of darkness, and of course, we would have to work by torchlight. The screens would be vital in maintaining our secrecy. Using the experience I had garnered at Tamiat, I'd worked out in detail how I should best proceed with the offloading. Now I supervised and instructed Dilbar and a gang of his men as they fashioned heavy pallets of dressed timber, which they prized from the deck of the first trireme. These were 8 cubits square and would fit into the hatches of the holds. Then, on the upper decks of each ship, I rigged tripods and pulleys over the hatches. From these, my men lowered the pallets into the hold, where other teams of workers packed the chests of bullion onto them. Then the chests were hoisted up to the deck in batches of 20, swung outboard and lowered to the wharf.
"What's in those chests, Taita?" demanded Tahuti.
I touched the side of my nose in a conspiratorial gesture. "That is the big secret, but very soon I will show you what it is. You will just have to be patient for a little longer."
"I never like having to be patient," Becatha reminded me, "even for a little longer."
A long line of men received the chests as they were unloaded from the pallets. The line stretched from the wharf through the entrance to the tomb, down 4 flights of stairs, and then along the painted and decorated tunnels, through the 3 vast antechambers, until they reached the 4 treasuries. The treasuries were sited closely around Pharaoh's burial chamber, with its empty sarcophagus awaiting the embalmed corpse, which never arrived. This vast complex had been hewn from the living rock, an endeavour which had taken me and 2,000 labourers 20 years to accomplish, and of which I am still rightfully proud. You girls can be of great help to Uncle Aton and me, I told the princesses. You can count, and you are able to write something that only 1 in 100 of these other dolts are able to do. I jerked my head at the line of toiling, half-naked men. The 2 girls entered into the roles of bookkeepers as though it were a game. They were delighted to show off their schooling. I had left instructions with Zaras, and in my absence he had set up 2 heavy balance bars in the first treasury. Now Aton and I each manned one of these. As the chests were suspended from the arm of the apparatus, we called the weight to the girls. Becatha worked with Aton while I had Tahuti as my assistant. They wrote down each weight on a long roll of papyrus and kept a running total after every 10th chest. When the first treasury was filled, it contained 233 lakhs of pure silver. I sent the men up to the surface and gave them an hour to rest, eat, and drink. When we were alone in the treasury, I took the respite to make good my promise to the girls to show them what the chests contained. I prized open the lid of one and took out an ingot, which I allowed them to handle and admire. "It isn't as pretty as my necklace," Becatha remarked, as she stroked the charm at her throat.
"Does it all belong to you, Taita?" Tahuti asked, thoughtfully,
as she looked around at the stacks of chests. "It belongs to Pharaoh," I replied, and she nodded seriously. I watched her making the calculation. She is good with figures. At last she smiled as she reached a total. "We are very pleased with you, Taita." She used the royal plural, as if by right. When the men returned, I put them back to work. They moved the balance bars to the second treasury chamber, which was slightly smaller than the first. In this we found space to store a further 216 lakhs of silver. At this stage, Zaras came in from the wharf to report that the first two triremes had been completely unloaded, but that there was still a substantial weight of treasure in the third and last ship to be brought ashore. "The dawn is close, Lord Taita," he warned me, for I had lost all track of the passage of the night, "and the men are almost exhausted." There was a trace of censure in his tone, and his expression was lugubrious. I thought to give him the sharp end of my tongue, for I am not accustomed to being criticized by my underlings, and I was myself tired but not exhausted. Despite my willowy physique, my stamina is greater than that of most men, but I restrained myself. "Your men have worked well, Zaras, as have you, but I am going to call upon your indulgence a little longer. I will come to the wharf with you to assess how much remains to be done." At this point, I made a fateful mistake. I glanced around at Tehuti, as she squatted on her stool behind me, with her head bowed over her papyrus scroll. Her hair had flooded down in a dense golden wave to screen her face. She had not found the time from her labours to comb it up again. "Tehuti, you have worked like a slave girl," I told her. "Come with me to the surface. A breath of cool night air will revive you." Tehuti stood up. She tossed her head and threw the hair back from her face, and she looked at Zaras. He looked back at her. I saw the pupils of Tehuti's green eyes dilate in the lamplight, and at the same time I heard the dark gods laugh. It was a far-off and mocking sound, but I knew instinctively that our little world had changed dramatically. The couple stood as still as a pair of marble statues, staring at each other. I tried to look at Zaras through her eyes, although I am a better judge of feminine rather than masculine beauty. I saw for the first time that he was handsome, far past the normal. Even though I knew his lineage was unremarkable, there was an imposing aura that surrounded him. He had a noble poise and bearing. I knew that his father was a merchant in Thebes who had built up a large fortune by his own efforts. He had seen to it that his son had received the finest education that silver could buy. Zaras was clever and quick-witted, and as fine a soldier as his military rank attested. However, his antecedents were lowly, and he was certainly no match for a princess of the royal house of Tammuz. In any event, Pharaoh would decide who would make that match, with a little advice from me. Quickly I stepped between the couple, breaking their eye contact. Tehuti looked at me as though I were a stranger whom she had never seen before. I touched her hand, and she shuddered slightly, and her gaze refocused on me. "Come with me, Tehuti," I commanded. I watched her face. With a huge effort, she regained control of herself. "Yes, of course. Forgive me. My thoughts were elsewhere, Taita. Of course I will go with you." I ushered her towards the door of the treasury. Zaras fell in behind her. There was elasticity in his step, and an expression of awe, mingled with elation, suffused his features. I knew him well, yet I had never seen him in this state. Once again, I interposed myself between the young couple. "Not you, Captain Zaras. See to it that the balance bars are transferred to the next treasury, and then the men can take another short rest." These were trivial orders to give to an officer of his rank, but he had to be distracted from his present dangerous fascination. Only now I realized that Tehuti and Zaras could never have met before. She lived in the little world of the palace harem, from which she was only allowed to emerge with a strict system of chaperonage surrounding her. I was perhaps the most important link in that protective chain. As a beautiful princess, her virginity was of inestimable value to the crown and the state. It was possible, of course, that Zaras might have seen her from a distance during one of the royal processions, or in the pageantry of the religious festivals. However, he had never served in the household guards. All his military service had been at the battlefront, or in the training and exercise of his troops. I was certain that until this day he had never been close enough to her to have any inkling of her extraordinary presence and beauty. I snapped a quick instruction to Zaras. "Feed the men and give an extra noggin of beer to each of them. Let them rest until I give the word to resume." Then I led the two princesses up to the surface, leaving Zaras staring after us.